Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.
Hello, and welcome back to Venus Rising. I'm your host, Callie Fell. Today, I have the privilege of sitting down with Dr. Kathleen Stock. Dr. Stock is well known in the United Kingdom and in the United States for bravely recognizing the importance of biological sex. She regularly discusses and writes on gender identity ideology and its effects on women and girls. Until October of 2021, Dr. Stock was professor of philosophy at the University of Sussex in the United Kingdom and was awarded an OBE for services to higher education in 2020. Most recently, Dr. Stock is the author of a new best-selling book titled Material Girls, Why Reality Matters for Feminism. Kathleen, thank you so much for joining me on Venus Rising.
Thank you for having me.
So if we may, let's start by talking about your career in philosophy and education. Fairly recently, you've been awarded an OBE in the last couple of years. And for those of us who are unfamiliar, mostly people in the United States probably, OBE stands for, if I've got this right, Officer of the Order of the British Empire. And it's a prestigious award presented to someone for making a great impact in their line of work. So for you, being education, which is amazing. So congratulations on that. And then my follow-up questions are, did you always have a passion for philosophy or for teaching? And why that route? Why did you become a professor of philosophy?
I'm afraid I don't have a very inspirational story. I kind of fell into it, I'm afraid. But then once I had fallen into it, I did realize that I had some talent in that direction. So I come from a family of educators, and my granny was a teacher. My dad is a philosophy lecturer, or was. So I was around people that talked about truth and reason and, you know, ethics and things like that from a very early age. And I did it at university. I thought, well, I'll try a bit of philosophy. I did French as well. I thought I'll just put some philosophy in there to see if I'm any good at it. I enjoyed it, did a PhD, and then got a job. And I suppose it was only after I got my job that I started to think, oh, actually, you know, this job is not just the narrow kind of research job that I thought it was. It actually required a huge range of skills. And I think I have some good communication skills and good teaching skills as well. So it suited me.
Yeah. Well, it seems like you do. I've watched many of your interviews, and of course, you've been awarded your award. And so, and you know, that there is something to say about falling into a career. I have a master's in reproductive physiology, which is also something that I fell into, and I completely love it. So I think there's something for being said that and to being open in a career.
I think most people's trajectories have some accident in them.
Yeah. And it sounds like from an early age, you were kind of taught or allowed to question ideas and ethics that were presented to you, which is...
Yeah, I was strongly encouraged by my dad to argue. I mean, mainly because I disagreed with a lot of things he would say. He would annoy me. I think I was born with the temperament that is quite argumentative, but it was certainly brought out in my home environment. And it was great because it showed me that you can disagree with people without, you know, falling out with them.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Well, we'll get into that a little bit later. I've talked at length with Libby Evans on that issue too. So we'll get into that. So I find it ironic that in 2020, you were awarded such a high honor for your impact in education, only to recently lose your job in the academy about a year later. And I'm sure that came as quite a shock to you. And before the holidays, I had the opportunity to have Kara Dansky on the show, and she wrote a piece for readers that was kind of describing what was happening to you at the University of Sussex. Her piece titled, Witch Trials Within the Academy. Have you read that piece? And do you mind sharing with our audience your story kind of as it unfolded at the university?
Sure. I don't know if I've read that piece because I was sort of in the eye of the storm at the end of last year, and there was a lot of pieces about me, and I didn't look at all of them. But so I've been speaking out and writing about the importance of biological sex and worries that I have with this coming idea of what's called self-ID. So it's very strongly in the UK at the moment, and it's internationally gaining influence too. And it's the idea, which I'm sure you'll get into with me, that your inner feeling of what's called gender identity, whether you really feel like you're male or female or neither, and that feeling may have nothing to do with your outward facts about your sex, your biological sex, that feeling should determine where you go in public space, you know, whether you get into female-only changing rooms, whether you get into female-only sports teams. And so in other words, you can be a male identifying as a female with no surgery, no hormones, just this feeling. And that is your criterion of entry into spaces and resources, sports, and so on. So I started, just to explain that, because that gives the background to this controversy, really.
Sure.
I started expressing strong doubts about this as a policy about 3 years ago, and immediately attracted a lot of attention, negative attention, both from people, other academics, students, members of the public, celebrities, you name it. So I was already controversial. And actually, the OBE that you're mentioning there, I was given for services to Academic Freedom, because I was trying to insist that we had to talk about these things. They were having a big impact. This policy, which is already being enacted in all sorts of places, schools, universities, healthcare, and so on, was having major impacts. And yet we were being told, you can't talk about it. And if you do have any doubts, you're transphobic. You don't like trans people. And that can be the only possible reason that you have these doubts. And I didn't think that was true. So I started writing and speaking about it. So I haven't been a very popular figure at my own university, my former university, Sussex, for some time. And then at the end of last year, basically it all came to a head. A group of, I believe, students, they were all anonymous, they were all masked, they were dressed in this kind of Antifa kind of styling, full face masks, and they basically mounted a campaign to make me quit or have me fired. So big posters everywhere, stickers, flares being set off on campus, graffiti, public demonstrations on campus, and a very intimidating manifesto. The sort of final straw for me was that the union that I formerly belonged to, the main union for university lecturers at my workplace, then backed the protesters effectively against me. And in that context, I just didn't feel I could stay. So I decided to resign. And so I did.
I find it, again, there's so much irony in this ideology. I feel like, you know, here you are just simply challenging some ideas without violence or force or, you know, hate, and then to have that right back at you, and then suddenly it's your fault.
I'm supposed to make my ideas are supposed to make students unsafe, and that was the theme of this campaign, that trans and non-binary students at this university, which is located in near Brighton, so it's the kind of heart of LGBT life in the UK. Brighton is the center of it. I was supposed to make them unsafe by my words and ideas. You know, I mean, yes, it did feel somewhat ironic when I was, having security equipment installed in my home that I was the one that was supposed to be unsafe. But anyway.
So what do you think is happening in academics? Like, your story is not new. You are one of many that this is kind of happening to. Donna Hughes, I'm thinking of Colin Wright, who wasn't a teacher yet, but, you know, can't find, you know, left academia. He's in our film Transmission, What's the Rush to Reassign Gender? But what do you think is happening? Why do you think?
I mean, in the UK, and I suppose this kind of models things that have already happened in the States. So we used to have a kind of nationalized education system, higher education system. I paid some money for my education, but people before me didn't pay. The state paid. And while you may have worries about that, it seems to me that the introduction of heavy fees for students has changed the culture in universities, so that universities are much keener now to do what students want, you know, to give them, we talk all the time about now about student experience. Are they having the right kind of experience? And the right kind of experience is one where they're not, you know, subject to anxiety or, you know, so it's a kind of, universities are also in competition with each other now where they didn't used to be in the UK. So trying to get students to come to us. So you try and advertise your progressive credentials and you advertise how this is a wonderful, welcoming, inclusive community, which all sounds great, of course, and would be great if it was true. but so you get into this kind of performative moralization and what I think Jonathan Haidt calls safetyism quite aptly, you know, the idea that like what frightens or makes you anxious must be a harm. But of course, some ideas might frighten and make you anxious. Sometimes that's a sort of journey you go through to get to the other end where you realize they were good ideas or that you think they're true. But it's becoming harder for controversial ideas to be prosecuted freely in this environment.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I hadn't actually thought about that, how, you know, students are entitled because they're now paying for, in your situation, their education. So they're entitled to a certain experience.
Yeah. That's that was explicit on some of the posters that were put up on campus about me, where it said, we do not pay £9,000 a year for Kathleen Stock's transphobia.
Wow.
I mean, obviously I reject the idea that I'm transphobic, but that's, you couldn't have it more blatant than that. You know, we pay, we should get to say whether she can be on this campus. And of course, I'm not teaching these students in particular. So it's just the mere presence of me is threatening. The fact that they know I'm on the campus somewhere is threatening.
A long way to go in life. So as a philosopher, someone trained to challenge what you're told and not just to accept it. And I like in your introduction to the book, you kind of talk about how people have these philosophical thoughts every day. And it's funny because my husband and I are going through the Matrix right now. And you actually refer to that, even thinking like, am I in the Matrix right now, is actually quite philosophical in thought. And I appreciated that. So and it sounds like you've kind of already answered this question, but do you think that young minds are having a hard time critically thinking about controversial topics and then are afraid to speak or have discourse about such topics? I mean, surely you teach students who are in fact willing to take on types of arguments, but then are just terrified to.
Yes. I mean, that's the thing to keep stressing. And you realize this when you do teach in the university, that like the majority of students are just like they always were, open-minded, critical, interested, curious. You know, this isn't, I wouldn't say this is a, intolerance is widespread in universities even now, but what is the case is that a small number of very vocal, highly intolerant, highly kind of very zealous kids and academics, a small group of them have the mic basically because they have social media. So they can then call people out. They can perform their own kind of virtuous actions in public. And that has a chilling effect on everyone else. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's also things to say about how university policies have become quite moralized now as well. But so there's all these sort of strains converging to create this problem. Mm-hmm. But it's not the fault of the average university student. It really isn't. They are a victim of this situation as well, because they're not getting the kind of education that they should be.
So do you have hope for academics? Do you have hope for the future? What's your projection on that?
Do I have hope? I'm not very generally a very hopeful person.
And that's okay. But
I don't believe in the progress narrative of history, I'm afraid. I'm not that kind of liberal. So I think we're just going to do our best to avoid the worst scenarios. That's the best we can hope for. Mm-hmm. So I have hope that we can avoid like complete destruction of the higher education system. But I mean, in the UK, there is now, the government has now produced some legislation, which is going to try and impose a duty on universities to actively promote academic freedom. Mm-hmm. And in the US, there's a new university that's emerging, which I'm affiliated with, called the University of Austin. And that's a initiative partly by Barry Weiss and various other people. So, and that's, it's going to be a university that really strongly endorses the value of free speech in a kind of symbolic way, I think. So the idea is that, you know, it galvanizes other places to think about the importance of academic freedom. So there are, I think, encouraging moves in this area, but there's also a lot of challenges. And social media is one of those challenges. And the privatization generally of the university system is another.
It seems like in talking with parents who, in your book, you briefly talk about the children who are transitioning, some as young as 3, but parents kind of talking about how social media has kind of, it's like this contagion, so to speak, and how it's also not just in academia, but in younger kiddos too. Is that University of Austin, is that something that's going to be online, or can you talk a little bit more about that? I'm kind of intrigued.
No, I think it is going to be a physically real entity. It's only in its early stages, and I think so that I'm going to go over to Austin in June and do meet with some other fellows and founders to do some teaching. I think some summer courses, but I think they're at a pretty preliminary stage right now. So I can't say, you know, with much, and I'm not one of the organizers. I'm on board, but I'm afraid I can't give you much detail about that. But there's stuff on the internet about it.
Yeah. Well, that's great. That's hopeful to me. So let's shift gears a little bit and talk about your new book, Material Girls, Why Reality Matters for Feminism. It's received excellent reviews. And can you tell us a little bit, tell our listeners what your new book is about, just very briefly, and what inspired you to write it?
Well, my book is about gender identity, this idea, which I have some worries about, that your inner state, whether you feel female or feel male or don't feel either of those things, is somehow more important socially, politically, educationally than the facts about your biological sex. And that's a very radical kind of idea, but it's become embedded in a lot of policy, and particularly in so-called progressive institutions. They really seem to be going for it. So now we have in the UK, we have, for instance, you know, males who are biologically male, nothing ambiguous about that. They have not had any surgery. They have not taken hormones. And in some cases, they don't have any kind of legal sex change. They haven't filled out any forms, got what we call a gender recognition certificate. So about as unadorned males as you can get in women's prisons on the basis of, I feel female.
Yeah, without any commitment to...
No, and some of them are sexual offenders, mm-hmm, against women. Mm-hmm. We also have police forces that record the crimes of males as crimes of women if the males say, I feel like a woman, including sexual offences. So, I mean, that's just two examples. We also have males in women's sports teams on the basis of identity. We have males who say they're lesbians. You know, they say that they're women, they say, and they're attracted to women, so they must be lesbians. And LGBT organisations agree, yeah, with this. So there's been a real radical reshaping, which I'm sure you know, and I think maybe it's coming to the US a little more slowly, but it's really strong in the UK, and it's coming into other European countries too through laws and policies that are being brought in right now. And there are problems with it, I think, yeah, for women, because the facts of biological sex remain, and the challenges of being female remain, whether or not we talk about them, mention them, or put them in laws and policies. So that's what my book's about. It's an attempt to go through the philosophy of it, because a lot of the progressive kind of, or so-called progressive moves in this direction are supposed to be underpinned by philosophy, like Judith Butler or Foucault, or these big names, which might be a bit intimidating and sound kind of authoritative. And I just go through the ideas and try and debunk them from a philosophical perspective, but also in a clear way, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And I really try and spell out the consequences as I see it for women and children and gay people as well, because there are consequences for them.
And you have a wonderful interview with Suzanne Moore that listeners can watch. I'll include the link in the bio of this episode. And it goes into detail about your first chapter of the book, which kind of dissects the history and talks about those philosophers that you just mentioned. And so I do encourage listeners to go to go listen to that. We won't get into it today because, like I said, you've already done an excellent job interviewing with Suzanne Moore on that. Your book has been pretty well received, from what I understand, from a lot of different types of people. There are people who don't agree with you that read your book and have given their peace of mind on it. There are people who are kind of alongside you in the trenches who've read your book and given it accolades. But did you have a target audience for whom you were writing this book to? Like, when, as you were sitting down, who did you want to read this book?
I suppose I was aiming it at people who are intrigued by the ideas and maybe a little bit susceptible to a bit of Butler and Foucault and sort of big names in the academic sphere. Because there's a lot of people, I think, probably people with a lot of common sense, people, you know, most common sense, won't need my book to tell them that there are two biological sexes, that, you know, that a lesbian is a female attracted to other females. You know, there's the conclusions don't, it's part of the sort of strange aspect of this whole controversy is that some of the conclusions are ones that we've grown up with, we didn't take as remotely controversial, that women should have their own changing rooms or that men should not be competing in races against women fairly. And now all of that is being challenged. So there are some people who think, will think quite rightly, I don't need to read a book to tell me those things because I already know them. But my book's really for those who are sort of a bit more unsure, and they've heard that there's like really important reasons why we should, mm-hmm. you know, we should say yes to all of this, and often in the name of justice and progress. Right. And I'm saying, well, hang on, actually, the ideas don't stack up, the science doesn't stack up, and the stuff about justice and progress doesn't stack up, because of course it's not really thinking about what justice and progress for women and right. children would be.
Right. Most of my friends or acquaintances, they're agreeing with the ideology largely because they don't want to offend or hurt anyone. And, you know, there's enough space in the world for everyone. And they're not critically thinking kind of about the implications that this has for women and girls. Could you? Yeah. And I feel like it's, you know, in the sports, and I saw a meme the other day and it was like, you know, top women in this sport, top women in, you know, government. And they're all men. And it seems like we're kind of just erasing women. Can you talk a little bit more in detail about what dangers you see that this ideology, especially when adopted by government, has for women and girls, and go a little bit more explicitly into detail there?
Well, I can give examples. So, I mean, apart from the ones I gave already about mm-hmm. prisons, and there's been sexual assaults in prisons as a result of these policies, and I think we should protect women in prison who are very vulnerable. There's also a big impact on data collection in the UK, because various data collecting organizations that are in charge of kind of mapping what, you know, you'd think they were in charge of mapping all sorts of statistics around things like race or class or economics or sex. They're not collecting information about sex anymore. They're collecting it about gender identity. So they're saying, you know, how do you feel? What's your gender identity? If you've got a female gender identity, tick this box. And they're not tracking actual sex. Now, that makes a big difference if you're talking about the impact of, say, pregnancy and maternity in the workplace or healthcare, because those things are to do with biological realities for women, not how people feel inside about their identity. So we're losing academic information about females and males, especially for certain demographics, certain kind of groups like younger people, because the more young people identify as trans or as non-binary or as, you know, the opposite sex, then the less we'll be able to capture their data in particular robustly. And that might have all sorts of implications, you know, bad implications. We won't know enough about them, and we won't know how women in particular are affected. And I mean, another example is that even within the trans population, we don't really know how many are female and how many are male, because different challenges are faced by these two groups. And there's a big difference between a 15-year-old girl who says she's a boy because she has autism or a history of trauma, or she's same-sex attracted and she feels very shameful about that. And there's a difference between her and a 45-year-old male who has a fetish and who is transitioning because they, you know, and they're married to their wife and they're not going to stop being married to their wife, you know, but they're now a woman. So that I think we need to be able to say, well, there's differences here. And that's not to criticize either group. It's just to say there's a difference that academics and statisticians need to know about. So that's just one issue. No,
it's good. And I've talked about these again with Kara and others. And I just want to drive the point home, kind of, you know, listeners might be like, okay, we already know how, but I want to drive it home because I don't think sometimes we're taking it seriously. Like what's at stake here?
I mean, it depends what kind of history of women's rights you already have in your country, I think, to some extent. I mean, obviously, I think in America, there's been some amazing feminist work done, but also there's some areas where I would say, in terms of, say, maternity leave, you know, I think UK has a better situation. But it's, do we take women's experiences and interests seriously or not? Right. You know, and it's clearly not in the interest, given what we know about sexual assault statistics, what we know about male sexuality, and that's not to say all males, but, you know, most sexual assaults are carried out by males on females. So why would we dismantle safeguarding policies around, you know, places where women get undressed to say, on the basis of sheer feeling, a man can legitimately go in there? That's a recipe for disaster. So do we care about those women? Or do we just think, oh, well, they're going to get raped anyway? Right. I don't think like that. So, you know, I think people should care about this because it's going to affect a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. And it's not just in the prisons. In California, we're seeing men being housed in women's prisons and they're passing out condoms now. Why would women's prisons need condoms? But tax dollars at work. And then, but it goes beyond that too. It's in the elementary schools. You know, these new policies are affecting young girls who we should care very much about, even if you don't care about the prison population, which you should, but you know, this affects young ones as well.
Why do you see the hell out of them?
What did you say? Say that again.
It confuses the hell out of them. I mean, no wonder it confuses them because we're telling them literally, you know, we're pointing to someone who looks like a female and saying, that's a male. Mm-hmm. You know, no wonder they are confused, and that may impact them because they may end up with some kind of confusion about themselves, which may lead to taking of drugs that will irrevocably change their bodies.
Sure.
And they might well have desisted. They might, if they'd been given time to work it out, time and space, then they may well have worked it out for themselves and thought, hey, I'm just a tomboy, or
right,
I'm just gay.
Right. We followed the Kira Bell case pretty closely here as it was coming out during the making of our film. And our film addresses little ones. It's not focused on adults transitioning, but like you said, young ones who think they might be the opposite sex because they don't fall into a stereotype of their gender, of those social roles. And so they go on to think that they need to change their bodies in ways that can't be reversed, and then do harm to themselves that way. In the last decade too, it seems like gender ideology has been really heavily politicized. And why do you think, seems like there's two things kind of in the news always, COVID and policy changes due to gender identity and trans ideology. Why do you think governments all over the world have latched on to this and have started to change policy so quickly?
That's a good question. I mean, it's been, I think it's multi-layered and I don't have a quick answer, but for instance, organizations like the UN are involved. So there's been a kind of relatively globalist strategy taken. And I think that a lot of the countries who bring in self-ID think that they're following what they call international best practice, but it's always a bit nebulous where international best practice got started. There's a lot of funding going into it. It's in the UK, it's seen as a kind of very progressive thing to bring in. It's seen by politicians as a kind of logical extension of gay marriage. You know, we've fixed things there. Now we're going to fix things for trans people. That generates its own revenue streams for organizations, which, you know, are getting it. You know, there's a well-known LGBT organization in the UK who, it was just announced, got £1.7 million from the government it was announced last week that they got it this year. So governments are funding organizations to tell them to change their policies in favor of self-ID, at least they are here. So yeah, that's part of the story. And then social media, I'm sorry to keep going back to it, but it's really, it's a social problem that's coming out of Tumblr and TikTok and Facebook, not so much, I don't know, Facebook, but I don't know if anyone does Facebook anymore. But we need to think about what social media is doing to young people. Mm-hmm. It's not just, you know, there's a rise in self-harm generally as a result of smartphone use. So there's a big complicated picture about things that influences operating at scale that we don't fully understand, I think.
Well, our time is running short and I don't want to keep you much longer. I know you're very busy, but if you had anything else to say to maybe parents who are, maybe have a young one who's thinking about self-IDing as an opposite sex, or maybe someone who's really on the fence about this ideology, what would your last comments to them be?
I would say if you're a parent, I mean, I feel for you for a start. It's a really complicated situation and the culture around you is telling you, in some circles anyway, you know, you must affirm your child's identity or else the child will commit suicide. You know, very hysterical things are being said, which are not based in evidence. But I think the challenge is to kind of not to panic and to try and carve a space where you're not particularly rigid about anything, you know. So I don't think it's necessarily a good idea to say, no, absolutely not. You know, you may not play with your identity in any way. You're just a girl. You know, that's not, I don't see that working for most children. But, you know, if you can kind of keep it flexible and playful, and because kids need to work through who they are and, you know, who they're attracted to and who they want to be. And they're bound to go through stages of kind of transformation developmentally, and it's going to be challenging to watch. But as long as no narrative gets sort of absolutely, if you can avoid anyway, narratives getting fixed that this is the real you, I think that will help, because they'll work out, if left alone, they'll work it out for themselves. I think most kids, you know, without any drama. I mean, so identifying as the opposite sex is not new. Our generation did it, you know, my mother's generation did it. There's always going to be girls that would prefer to be boys and vice versa. But it's the way we're handling it that has changed, and the way we're rigidifying it and making it like an inner essential state of children when it's just not.
So it sounds like, you know, adopt the philosophical approach, right? Allow questions, allow investigation, you know, question the ideas. Well, I want to thank you so much for refusing to be silenced, for writing your book, for coming on our show today. It's been an absolute privilege to have you and to learn more about you. I really appreciate it.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Yeah. Listeners, I encourage you to support Dr. Stock by purchasing and reading her important and well-written new book, Material Girls. And follow her at Twitter at DocStock. That's DocStock. It's true that the book has been very well received, but because of reluctance in the industry to promote it, its success relies on you and word of mouth recommendations. You can also find more of Dr. Stock's work and writings on her website, kathleenstock.com. And I will include that in the bio so you know how to spell it. Our goal, as ever, is to create conversation, facilitate discussion, and encourage you to think beyond the masses. Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.